Manifold.
Yeah, okay.
The use of this type of material was kind of unique in the size of the turbine manifold. For instance, the turbine wheel is 35 inches in diameter. So to fabricate a manifold that can operate up to in the neighborhood of 1775 degrees Fahrenheit, at this size, you can imagine the thermal expansion problems that you have. And this material is not the easiest material to weld and fabricate without inducing fabrication stresses. So it took quite a bit of development work to solve all of the potential problems with using a manifold of that nature.
I think Rene 41 was originally developed by General Electric, and we took it over for this application and had to make significant advances in the processing or fabrication techniques and making it into a manifold. The welding problems were really fantastic. As a matter of fact, so bad that at one point we considered, after we had delivered the first three vehicles worth of engines, we considered changing, making a change at that point and going to a Hastelloy C manifold. However, by the time we had that as a backup development item, and by the time we got to the qualification configuration, we had arrived at enough confidence in Rene that we could proceed with it. But there were many times during the program where it looked like we were going to have to scrap out that material. We just could not fabricate it satisfactorily. We had weld failures, we had operational failures, we had a lot more fabrication problems than we had operational problems, however.
But what did GE use it for?
I don't honestly know.
Hydroelectric?
I don't know what they used it for, but it was a product of their research laboratories at GE.
I see, okay.
And I don't know what their application was. Mm-hmm. But as Joe said, good part of Rene 41, it is a very high strength, high temperature alloy that needs some specific heat treating operations and things of that nature. But boy, its fabrication problems were, as I say, we're on the threshold of scrapping it numerous times.
You might say, why did we go that way? Why not take another material like Hastelloy or some other material? All of these other materials have to operate at a lower temperature. Mm-hmm. And as you decrease the turbine temperature, you lose efficiency. Mm-hmm. So the higher temperature you can operate at, the more efficient the whole engine will be and keep the engine performance up.
Basically,
so that's basically the trade-off.
Yeah, simply stated, the power out of a turbine is a product of the flow rate through the turbine and the temperature that the turbine operates at. And you can see that if you need a certain power level and you drop temperature, you have to increase flow rate. The most efficient rocket engine operates at a minimum gas generator flow rate because you want to really combust most of the flow at high temperature. The gas generator must combust at a relatively low temperature, 15, 16, 1700 degrees. So you try to get the flow rate down and the temperature up so that you have a minimum amount of flow this loop and most of the flow going into the main chamber. So it became to our advantage to go as high a temperature as possible. By the way, to give you a feel for that, the other engines operated up to this time at about 1200 degrees Fahrenheit. As the turbine manifold temperature, we were going up to about 1600 degrees in the F1. We actually did some at 1700, actually.
We have a maximum operating point to 1775 degrees. And the temperature does increase during flight about 100 degrees or so, just due to the acceleration effects of the propellant coming into the engine. With a LOX tank on top of the fuel tank, the head developed due to the flight acceleration loads increases the pump inlet pressure on the LOX side more than on the fuel side. Mm-hmm. So consequently, being an orifice engine rather than a regulated controlled engine, it operates strictly on a delta P principle. So consequently, if the head increases on the LOX side more than the fuel side, there's a tendency to get a slight change in performance or mixture ratio.
And you get more oxidizer flow. Then you will fuel flow, and that causes the temperature to go up.
One of the other features that all rocket engines prior to this time had was They operated their turbine at much higher speeds and used a gear reduction system to drive the turbopumps. In the case of the F1 turbopump assembly, it's all in one common shaft. So the pump speed and turbine speed is the same. There is no gearbox arrangement in the F1 turbopump. This had several advantages. One, needless to say, you eliminate the gear system. One of the major things that it did is eliminated the need of an auxiliary lubrication system to operate the turbo pump with. As we found that the bearings can be lubricated with the RP fuel, where if you have a gear drive system, you need more than just the lubricity of the fuel. You either have to use a lube oil or an additive fluid to the fuel to provide adequate lubrication of the gear train.
Where was the tap for the RP1?
Pardon?
Where's the tap for the RP1?
Okay, the RP1 taps right off of the fuel high pressure duct volute, goes to what we call the bearing coolant valve, which is just a series of two parallel cracking check valves. It goes through that system, and it's filtered at this point too to make sure that all impurities are taken out. Then it's just injected right back in and squirted right on the bearings within the turbo pump. And then the residual drainage comes out and runs down these overboard drain lines.
I was going to say, yeah, as you put that back in the system, you just got rid of it.
We just dump it overboard.
It's a very small flow rate.
But yeah.
Joe is exactly right, but the problems that we had in the development of the Atlas and Thor engine systems in the gear area were very appreciable. So one of the design ground rules for the F1 was to eliminate gears if at all possible. And what we do on the other engine systems, we have what we call a fuel additive blender unit. And what we do is we take the fuel off just like Joe described, but instead of just putting it right into the turbo pump, we put it through a blender unit that has a high lubricity oil in it that mixes with the fuel, and we use that to lubricate the gears. But you can see we could eliminate all that complexity if we could eliminate that gear train. Now, typically what you'd like to do is have a turbine operate in the neighborhood of about, oh, on this size engine, maybe about 30,000 RPM. And you want the impeller operating on the pump maybe in the order of 5,000 RPM. So you'd have to have like a 6-to-1 gear ratio, and that creates some problems. So if we could get a turbine to operate efficiently down at around 5,000 RPM, we could go on a direct drive basis, eliminate the gearbox, and eliminate all the auxiliary lube oil system we'd have to have. And that was a major accomplishment. It was set out as the original design objective to go that way. And another one of those things that did work out. We were able to develop a relatively efficient turbine at that low speed.
It's very interesting how self-contained these units are.
That's right.
It is to me.
That
really
was
remarkable.
Yeah. That was one of the major goals in this whole F1 program, was to operate the entire hydraulic system and everything within its own, within itself.
Yeah.
The entire hydraulic system is operated off of fuel discharge pressure. The coolant to the bearings in the turbo pump are fuel pressure. So essentially, as long as you could continue to provide propellants to this engine, it would just continue to run.
Operating.
That's right. There's no auxiliary system that's going to run out of an expendable on you. Once you get it started, it'll just continue to operate on its own. Similarly, I was saying that even though the Boeing company provides the gimbal actuators to move the engine and control the thrust vector, this boss here right off the high pressure duct is where the fuel is tapped off to operate the gimbal system. It provides a hydraulic power to Boeing to do that. And then when they get done, they just bring it right back here and bring it into the hydraulic return system. And the hydraulic return fluid is not expelled overboard. That goes right back to the fuel pump inlet over here through this duct. It's dumped right back in the pump inlet again. So even though we take it off, use the pressure available to operate the system, when the fluid is passed through the system, it's just injected right back into the fuel system.
Does that
again.
Go through a filter before it gets in there then?
We pass it through a filter when we take it off the duct. It comes off the fuel high pressure duct here through this line. This is the engine control valve. The bottom portion of this valve is made up of three filter cartridges. So it's filtered going into the valve, goes through the control valve, out to the operate the other propellant valves, and it's filtered again when it does that.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's just returned without any additional filtration back to the pump inlet.
Mm-hmm.
The engine system itself is not very susceptible to particulate contamination of the size we're worried about. The only concern we have is in the small control valves and the hydraulic gimbal system and things of that nature. So the main thing is to filter going into those
that's
units,
so that's
and
out.
On its return, the engine it, yeah. system that is not very sensitive. Now,
mm-hmm.
obviously, we're sensitive to major things like nuts, bolts, and things like that going through a turbo pump. But minor contamination problems
yeah.
is of no major significance.
And if you get a particulate lodged in the injector nozzle, it's going to get burned out in a pretty damn hurry
right,
anyway.
It does.
Yeah.
Joe, you might comment, now that you've talked about the self-contained operation, you might talk about the development of the pressure ladder sequence that was used.
Okay, to another feature that was first used on a production engine, rocket engine, was the fact that we don't have an auxiliary start system on the F1. Like Paul told you on the J2, for instance, you have a start bottle
mm-hmm.
that you have high pressure gas that you spin down through the turbine to get the engine started with.
How do you start the thing? You know, like we do in almost every other engine system, we have a big start system that's pressurized, and it starts the turbine flowing and everything picks up from there. The F1 doesn't operate that way. It
yeah.
has no start bottle.
In the case of the F, we found that we could affect the satisfactory start just by using and operating a gas generator initially off the head pressure developed at the pump inlets. They tank the stage, so you pick up some static head just due to the mass of fluid above the inlet, and they pressurize the tanks to a relatively low pressure, and that pressure is sufficient that we can actually go into the start sequence and open the gas generator valve under that low head and develop enough power in the combustion process at that low head to start the whole turbine drive system up to speed. And then the engine, as the speed of the turbine increases, the discharge pressure increases, increasing the flow to the gas generator, and just brings the whole power level right on up. So consequently, the F1 engine doesn't start quite as quickly as you see some other engines start.
Yeah.
If you've seen like an H1 engine, they have a turbine spinner, which is a solid propellant charge that they attach to the GG combustor. And they light that off, and the solid propellant gases wind the turbine up to speed,
mm-hmm.
for instance. In the case of the J, they blow it down through this start bottle. So consequently, starting out at the lower power level, the F starts a little slower. It takes us about 3 seconds to get all the way in the main stage, which is relatively slow for a rocket engine. But it completely eliminated the entire start technique used by all the other ones, all the auxiliary equipment. So here again, that made it rather self-contained. See, when we, as we got going along in the program, the NASA people ran some studies based on a lot of experience they gained from the S-1B Saturn vehicles on thermal environment in the aft end of the vehicle. So as a result of that, the heat values that we were going to be exposing the engine to, as you know, in the aft end of the Sat-5, the engine stick all out exposed. So as a result of that, we had to develop a thermal insulation material to insulate the engine, because the temperatures in that region get up in the neighborhood of 2,000 degrees
yeah.
in flight, which is pretty hot.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, we completely encase the entire engine in thermal insulation. I got some, I don't know if you've ever seen any photographs of that.
We did show on the film, but I showed the jet engine test series. I'm not sure they got a chance to absorb it all, but
this gives you an idea. that would completely enclose the entire engine.
Now this is would
with
be
thermal
like
insulation
for a flight vehicle as well.
Yes, this is what we use for flight. For static test on the ground, we do not require that. Mm-hmm. Even in cluster testing, it's not required.
Is the engine shipped in this boat, or do you put that on after it gets down there?
That's installed at Cape Kennedy.
Uh-huh.
We deliver the thermal insulation essentially as loose equipment, and we deliver it to the government, who then provides it to the Boeing company, who installs it at the Cape. It's after the various stages of the Saturn V are mated. Matter of fact, I might just mention that on vehicle 510, which is at the Cape now, we're in the process of installing thermal insulation.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, it's usually done about 4 or 5 months prior to launch.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get any problem inside there with vapor being trapped, rust, and things like that, 4 or 5 months?
That, needless to say, once you encase the whole engine, then that brings up the whole question of potential leaks and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it much more critical from the standpoint of assuring that we don't have leaks within the envelope of the insulation material.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a major concern to both us and NASA.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, we have to go through a lot of procedures to assure that we don't have leaks within the system.
That's probably one of the most perplexing problems in rocket engine development, is the essentially zero leak requirements that we have on joints, and joints that operate in pressures in the neighborhood of 2,000 psi, and we must have absolute confidence we have zero leakage. And you can see that this develops a whole new field of how do you measure zero.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to be facetious, that's very serious as to the techniques to be employed to measure an allowable leakage.
Mm-hmm.
And in most cases, in a common industry, they have a leakage allowable of maybe a small number, but at least it's an allowable leakage. In the F1, as a matter of fact, in almost all rocket engine systems, especially one where you have an entrapped area, you have to assure zero leakage. And that becomes a whole new problem in the development of seals, and what kind of seals are to be used in all these interface joints to provide this, so we get into things like silver coating of seals, and we get into a product developed by Rocketdyne called a Naflex seal, which is a pressure actuated seal, which means that it's a seal that actually works better at pressure than it does without. Let me just describe very simply a principle to you. If you had a joint like so, you put a seal in that looks like this. Okay, it has two legs on it essentially. Okay, and you can see that what happens is pressure is built up in this line, you force these legs to seal, so the seal actually works a lot better at high pressure than it does at low pressure. Now, by the way, that creates another set of problems, because most of the checkouts that we're going to do are going to be at low pressure. Okay, and so now this seal may very well leak at low pressure, but it's not going to leak at high pressure. But you have to develop the absolute confidence that it's not going to leak at high pressure. So how do you know you don't have something in there that's causing the leak? So now you have to develop a Naflex seal that not only operates satisfactorily at low pressure, but also at high pressure, but also at low pressure.
About what time are you figuring going?
About 5 minutes. 10.
All right.
10 minutes, I think. So that gives you another area that we had a extensive development in, was in seals. By the way, if you want to extensive dialogue on seals, there's a guy at Huntsville who's almost made it his life's work, and that is Hans Paul.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah. He's just real big on that.
Yeah. Hans is a guy. He
got a little teeny part one day, and the connector.
I think if you
would, about 18 different flanges on it to connect up.
I think if you were to ask Hans personally, what is the biggest single development required in the rocket engine industry, he would tell you the seals area. He really feels that was the major technological accomplishment that had to be achieved. And because you can see in the hydrogen engine, is a fuel leak by itself causes a fire. Mm-hmm. High pressure hydrogen and air will ignite. By the way, on the RP engines, high-pressure fuel in the presence of any heat. For example, if we should have a fuel leak and just drip any fuel onto this manifold, this will ignite in air. So you can see that, and you put that under a thermal insulation cocoon. There's numerous wires in here, obviously, for instrumentation purposes, for control sequences, and a fire under that thermal insulation cocoon could cause a mission abort if we should fail a series of wires or whatever.
Can I ask you a question that has nothing to do with what they're talking about, but in some of the early proposal studies, the standard one that was brought it up was to be used as a test bed for the F1 engine. You take out the four middle engines and you put in an F1, and then you'd control it with the four outboard engines. Do you ever hear anything about that?
No. That concept was never developed.
Never used.
It may have been proposed various times, but you're thinking more along the line like some of the jet engines are developed by hanging a new jet engine on an existing airplane, like a B-52 or something, and check them out. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, that principle has never been used in the rocket business. They probably have considered it, but it's never been used. I think we probably covered most of the features along that line. I still don't have the copy yet. We're trying to get it through reproduction, but I have a whole list made up similar to this list that Paul gave you, showing a lot of the engine features and where we had used existing technology from either prior engines or other industry in the development of the engine. And it's quite an extensive list.
I think what we'll probably do is write this up when we get back. It might take a couple of months because we have some other things we're working on as well, parallel to this. And then just send it back to you, probably before giving it to Dave Akins and things, so you can kind of check that out.
Okay, sure. I think that would be really appropriate to do something like that. And if we felt that there are other points that should be added in, we can just draft up something that we'd recommend for you. You can put it in your terminology. We'll at least discuss what we think is significant.
Well, that'd be marvelous, yeah.
The only criterion is if you fall asleep within 15 minutes, we're successful.
Maybe we've accomplished the same thing here with you.
Yeah, well, I guess my approach to this, of course, is to load you fellows up with a lot more information than you could possibly use.
That's exactly what we need
but,
to do.
But then from that, you can filter down rather than having you try to add some stuff your own, which we kind of feel you're not qualified to do unless we explain it all to you. So.
And then Merlin the magician went out to the test stand, Dan.
By the way, that could be developed.
Facilities concept.
Might be worth your while to explore that a little bit. For example, we mentioned to you the fact that we were an attempt to develop that injector and the thrust chamber. Rather than build an entire engine system, we constructed a component test stand that would operate the chamber at its nominal operating conditions without a pump. So that meant that we had to build a facility which the pressurized tanks could withstand maybe 3,000 pounds pressure in an enormous size vessel. And that took some technology. Maybe not as much technology as just fabrication process and operational problems. There she is.
Finally.
Thank you. For example, we have an addition to the engine stands that you saw. As a matter of fact, maybe that film would be worthwhile trying to get a copy for you so you could review now and then. We did have a separate three-position turbopump stand just for a turbopump. We had a separate gas generator development component test stand. We had, as I said, the injector and thrust chamber development test stand. We had a heat exchanger development stand. And so numerous facility items like this that had to be constructed and then modified for their singular purpose of to fit F1 hardware or J2 hardware, whatever the case may be. In addition to that, there was considerable environmental facilities that you saw in the film. On the F1, we have a complete environmental stand where we can simulate both cold and hot conditions, determine the effects of heated fuel, heated oxidizer, chill down components within the engine system, and that took a, again a significant development.
Was that up at Susie or is that down here?
Most of the, well, the F1 engine stands and thrust chamber development stand at Edwards Air Force Base, the gas generator stand, the heat exchanger stand, and the turbo pump stand are all up at Santa Susana.
Mm-hmm.
We, in addition to that, have environmental facilities here in the plan to do component work. As you saw, we have to do of fungus, salt spray,
high temp, low temp
vibration on components. That's done in our laboratory out here at Canoga Park.
Mm-hmm.
So numerous facilities in that.
We had one of the largest vibration facilities in the country here with 30,000 pound shaker tables.
30,000 pounds of force
being
applied.
So, as you can imagine, you take a component like this that weighs a couple hundred pounds, a main LOX valve, and then you have to shake it, maybe inject something like 50 G's to it, and it takes a pretty healthy shaker table.
So it's above and beyond the earthquake facility.
That's right.
The problem with the earthquakes is a little bit unpredictable as yet, and so it's.
As a result of that, we had one of the most advanced and largest capability vibration facilities in the country here.
Are they still out here?
Yes.
We still have most of it. Some of the equipment has been sent to Marshall now.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, it was so large a facility that they've actually taken an entire J2 engine, mounted it upside down on the vibration table, and shaken the whole thing.
Shook the whole engine.
Okay.
Now there is a huge facility at, not at Marshall, but in Huntsville, which is called a static test dynamic facility or something like that, and I think
the
it's
dynamic test facility.
Dynamic
tower.
Test facility,
yeah.
The tower,
yeah.
Where they actually attempt to simulate the vibration on the entire stack
yeah.
or
yeah.
stage.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, you know, comparable areas. Again, I don't want to say that we have the only ones. We have the only ones applicable for engine operation or
mm-hmm.
engine investigation. I'd like to go back just for a second. What we consider one of the major breakthroughs also is that thrust chamber development. At the time of the F1, the chambers being built by Rocketdyne were all hand brazed chambers. We had nickel.
Mm-hmm.
We were building nickel chambers and brazing them by hand, going down, physically going down with a torch between every tube, okay? Appreciate the problem doing something like that on an F1. The original nickel chambers on F were hand brazed, but we had always envisioned and finally were successful in developing a high temperature furnace, where all of our chambers are furnace brazed now, and sometime after lunch I hope you get a chance to walk out to the manufacturing facility.
Exactly.
They're almost, unfortunately, all in a dormant stage now, but give you a feel for what the size of some of these furnaces are.
Mm-hmm.
We braze our injectors in a furnace. It's a furnace braze operation
mm-hmm.
that we operate in. Very, some of the furnace limitations are very close control limits. For example, I think we braze the F1 chamber at something like 1980 degrees plus or minus 20, or some very close tolerances. You got to get the braze temperature up in order so that you get the proper brazing taking place. And if you go too high, you start melting. I'm sorry, 1980 is the melting point of copper. So we braze, I think, at 1810 plus or minus 20. But again, very tight tolerances. And by the way, when you get into fabrication processes, we could talk for days with the materials and processes people about the development of braze alloys and to assure adequate braze and what materials you use and what the eutectic effects are and how to prepare braze joint gaps and welding and inspection techniques is another whole area. How do you inspect some of these things?
Mm-hmm.
And so we can go on and on.
That's why we have your phone number.
But instead of going on and on, why don't you go on to lunch? Sound like a good idea?
Explain what reliability is.
Okay, reliability.
I'll give a couple real quick definitions that are not the ones we're going to talk about. But reliability is often used in the sense of a reliability program, which means you do certain disciplines, that if you do them thoroughly, you do a good job and you get a better engine faster. That's one use of the word.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is simply the group who makes sure you do those things. Now, I'm not going to discuss those two, but I mean they are used in those that sense.
Okay. Now, I think it's important, let me just comment, sorry, in view of the fact that if you look at the film, in the film we talked about really reliability assessment. And I think Charlie's first definition here is important, that there are other disciplines that go into reliability other than just assessment.
Oh, yes.
For example, there are things like design review, and that is that you design a part and you form a group of experts in the field of design who will critically assess and review and question the designer and the design team on, did you consider this? Is it operationally fail-safe? How do you bleed that particular area? How do you know you don't have a gas trap? And numerous questions in the design area, which are not discussed at all in the reliability aspect of the film. He points out here standardization, okay? A standard parts manual. What do you use? When do you use what and where? And what are some of the ramifications of that? Failure mode analysis. We have done a lot of work in the failure effects analysis, determine how a part can fail and how to design it so it can't fail in that particular mode. Or that's what he refers to as failure mode analysis and elimination. Now, all of those aspects of reliability are not discussed in the film at all and as a part of the overall operation. The one I thought we were going to talk about a lot more would be the mathematics of reliability and how do you compute it and how do you determine how many tests must be conducted and how do you determine confidence levels and things of that nature.
Under three, I give a brief introduction lead up to this, but I don't really get into it because we could spend all week on that. But to give you a feel for it, I did